Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to the little book of Habakkuk. And if you have to use your table of contents, don't worry about that. That would not be surprising for most readers of the Bible, because this is not a book that we come to very often. Habakkuk, I believe, is prophesying in the time period we've been camped in for several sessions now, and that's 605 BC. This is the year that Nebuchadnezzar becomes the king of the Babylonian Empire. This is the year that the first exiles from Judah are taken away to Babylon. That'd be Daniel and his friends and many others. So this is the beginning of the Babylonian domination, and even to some extent, the word desolation applies, of the kingdom of Judah. And it is also the beginning of God's punishment through the Babylonians of many of the kingdoms of the Middle East for their sins, including the kingdom of Judah, by the way. So Habakkuk is a man living in that time period, and he looks at the injustice of it all and the unfairness and how bad people seem to be getting away with bad things and how good people are suffering because of that. And God is not intervening. And Habakkuk even asks, aren't you even listening, God? Why are you just sitting by and not doing something? And that does make us uncomfortable when people kind of yell at God like that and demand answers from him. But it is the cry of the heart, isn't it? And all of us have more than likely at some time had that same feeling. Why, God, does evil prevail and good seems to be taking it in the head? And God's response to Habakkuk was probably not the type of message he wanted to hear, but it was basically this. Habakkuk, I am going to intervene. I am going to do something. I'm going to use the Babylonians, and I am going to judge the entire Middle East through their actions, and it's going to be rough and chaotic. Now, that couldn't have made Habakkuk very happy. I mean, Jeremiah, who is from this same time period, has been warning that's where it's heading for quite some time, and nobody wants to hear that from him. They even tried to kill him at one point, and eventually he'll be arrested for having that sort of message. But Habakkuk decides to talk to God about some other things, and so that's where we pick it up today. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O he who is my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. Now, what's he expressing here? Is he expressing that there won't be death and destruction coming on Judah? I don't think so. I think that he might instead be expressing that eternal faith that we see in the New Testament phrase something like this. He who believes in me shall never die. And he who believes, even if he should die, he shall live again. So it's the idea that the real us, the core of us, the soul of us, cannot be killed by actions in this world, peoples of this world, even the demonic forces. That soul lives forever and will go into the presence of the Lord unscathed, even if we die horribly. So I think that might actually be the faithful expression that he's giving. But he continues. He says, Oh, he who is, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. So that's in reference to the Babylonians, that God's going to use them as a punishing tool. Verse 13, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you sit idly and look at traitors and are silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? Oh my goodness. So Habakkuk, even though he acknowledges that God is going to intervene using the Babylonians, is still upset that he's not doing something like right this moment to deal with the bad guys. And we can appreciate that he is a human being. He is a prophet. He has God giving him information, but he is just like the rest of us, and he gets frustrated. And so he wants God to do something now. And this is how he expresses his feelings about this. He says, you make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. So mankind kind of feels for the moment to be just the animal world to you. Verse 15, he brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. And so he rejoices and is glad. And therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. So he pictures a pagan fisherman here. A pagan fisherman that goes out and just throws his net in the sea and grabs a whole big bunch of fish, drags them back to land, and butchers them. And then he offers thanks to his gods and the net itself for feeding him and making him rich. Verse 17, Habakkuk says, is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? So this is the question about Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. Do they get to just keep doing what they're doing, killing people and taking people into exile? Is that what they get to do? Then Habakkuk starts looking for the answer to his complaint. Chapter 2, verse 1. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. Now, I do find this a little bit interesting that he would have a very specific place that he wants to go and wait for God's answer. And it happens to be some sort of watchtower, some sort of watchpost. Now, you might think then, does that mean he was a member of the Judean army? That's possible. But it could be that this is a non-military watchpost, such as a place where shepherds would keep an eye on the area around where their flocks were located. Or a watchpost that would be in vineyards or orchards to make sure that the crops were not being attacked, as it were, by animals or by humans that were coming in and harvesting at unauthorized times. So whatever it is, this is where he goes to wait for God to answer him. And God does. Habakkuk 2:2. He who is answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so that he may run who reads it. Now, some people get the impression that the ancient peoples were just predominantly illiterate, but that was not the case. It's just that written materials were so much harder to produce. So the way that they would deal with that is that when something did need to be read, they would put it on something and publicly, prominently display it. I think one of the best Old Testament examples of this is something that Moses, because of God, told the Israelites to do with his word once they got into the promised land. They were to whitewash a whole bunch of upstanding stones and then inscribe on them the words of God. Now, the debate is it just the Ten Commandments? Is it just the Book of Deuteronomy? Or is it the entirety of Moses' writings? And I must tell you, I can't come to my own absolute conclusion on that. I lean between Book of Deuteronomy and all of Moses' writings up to that point. But irregardless, that was a place, Shechem, that people could come to at any time and read the words of the law right there in front of them. So in later times in Israel, such as this, anything that the people needed to know was put on a tablet and prominently displayed. So God tells Habakkuk, make a public written proclamation of the vision that I give you. Write it out in large enough letters and clear enough letters that somebody in a hurry is going to see it and be drawn to it. All right, so this is like the old colonial newspapers that used to get put up in prominent places, and people would run to it and read it. And sometimes people would read it out loud to everybody else. Okay, verse 3. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Now, Jeremiah is going to experience this a lot. But there's a lot of people living in this time period that are saying, the Babylonians will never take this place. Jerusalem will never be taken by a foreign nation. Temple of the Lord, Temple of the Lord, Temple of the Lord. Ark of the Covenant, Ark of the Covenant, Ark of the Covenant. They kind of thought that Jerusalem was already a strong, fortified city, but it was also the place where God's temple was located. And that would be a supernatural protection. And the temple was where God's throne, the Ark of the Covenant, was located. And that also would guarantee protection. So these people would keep saying, that's not going to happen. You don't know what you're talking about. It's not happened for a long time. And Jeremiah's been talking about it for 23 years and it's never happened. So things like that. So Habakkuk is told by God, look, it may feel like it's not going to happen. It may feel like a long time has been going since I've been saying these things, but I guarantee you it will take place. Think about the New Testament book, 2 Peter, where Peter says that there's some scoffers running around saying, where's this coming of the Lord that you've been talking about? Everything seems to be just going on just like normal. And that was only 30 years after Jesus left and promised to be back. Imagine today, there's a lot of people that mock the Christian belief in the second coming. And so here is an Old Testament example of people mocking or feeling unconvinced because of the delay of the promises of judgment. Verse 4, behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Now, this gets quoted in the New Testament. The righteous one shall live by faith. You can find it in Romans 1:17, Galatians 3:11, Hebrews 10:38. It is a prominent phrase that makes its way into the Christian belief system. Now, this is what it means. The righteous one gets to live, you know, not die because of their faith. And so the people of Habakkuk's day should not take pride and get puffed up and think that they are never going to face judgment. Instead, they need to humble themselves, live the righteous life, and that is the one thing that will keep them safe into eternity. And it will very likely save the remnant that gets to go into exile. Verse number 5. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. Apparently, drunkenness is causing some troubles at this time. One of the ways that a lot of people deal with worry and troubles is to just forget about it by drinking themselves to ignorance. So, moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who's never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So that's not the answer. That's not the way to deal with the issue of coming judgment. Verse number 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges? Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them. Now let's talk about the generic understanding of this first. Generic understanding is some of those people that are being unfair in the days of Habakkuk. That's going to come back and bite them eventually. They are eventually going to be caught up with their injustices and their unfairness. And some of the people that they've been most unfair to will then be their judges. And that's not going to go well. But remember that Habakkuk has been told that the king of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, is going to be used by God to bring judgment against the Middle East, including against Judah, and that it's going to be rough, and that he's going to take people into exile. And Habakkuk kind of thought that that was a little bit unfair, that God was basically allowing the Babylonians to overfish. But God reminds Habakkuk that even the Babylonians will be held accountable for how they carry out God's judgment. This has already been the case with the Assyrians. God talked about using the Assyrians like a straight razor, shaving the legs of northern Israel and other countries because of their sin. But then, because Assyria thought that it was all that in a bag of chips, that they were the ones that were getting to do all this stuff, God was going to take them down for their sins, for over-applying themselves to the task at hand. So the Assyrian Empire has just come to an end at the hands of the Babylonians because of what they did when God used them as a judgment tool. So the Babylonians, who will go overboard as well, they will have to suffer God's judgment. Verse number 8, because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, and to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. So that is a warning that's woven into Habakkuk's prophecies, that yes, Babylon will be used as God's judgment tool. But because they will overplay their hand, God will judge them. And that's exactly what happens. The Medes and the Persians come in. Verse 11, for the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Now, what is that all about? It's basically even the architecture is going to be wanting judgment against the Babylonians for the way that they have carried out the judgment of God. Verse 12, woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from he who is of the hosts that peoples labor merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of he who is, as the waters cover the sea. So in the midst of all of this stuff, even though God ends up using a nation to judge other sinful nations, and then he turns around and uses other nations to judge that nation because they overdid the judgment because they're also a sinful nation. In the midst of all of this, God is still making all things work together for good to those who are the called according to his purposes, the beloved ones, the elect. And eventually, it will all be sorted out. And the first coming of Jesus was to deal with sin in the individual, to give everybody a chance to call upon his name, to die with him and rise again into a new life. The second time Jesus comes, he will be coming to bring judgment on those that have refused to have a relationship with him. And once he has come, then the earth will be filled with the personal knowledge of God's glory. Just like the waters are all over the sea. When you look over the sea, it's water. And when you look at the new earth in which righteousness dwells, you see God's glory. That's what Habakkuk is promised. Verse 15. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. Wow. Now, on a personal level, that is horrendous. The idea of trying to get somebody drunk so you can take advantage of them sexually. Well, that's also kind of applied to the larger nations that do things to their neighbor nations just to take advantage of them. Verse 16. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself, show your uncircumcision. The cup of he who is his right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. Now, do you remember that Jeremiah was going around with a symbolic cup? Well, here it is being mentioned again. The cup of wrath that's going to have to be drunk. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all that dwell in them. So there's a lot in here about the impending judgment of Babylon, which will be used for judgment now, but will come under judgment later. Verse 18, what prophet is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. We've also seen this in Jeremiah and other places. How crazy it is to be an idolater, where you go out into the woods, you chop down a tree, and then you bring it back home and you shape it in the shape of a person or an animal, and then you silver plate it or gold plate it. Maybe you'll use bronze. And then you attach it to a stand so that it doesn't wiggle around. And then you put it over in a special place and you bow down in front of it and go, oh, thank you for making me. What? Or you take the things that you chopped off of it and you burn that to keep you warm, or you cook over it to make bread for yourself. Pieces of what was your God. So it's just insanity. He continues, for its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. So you make something and it can't even talk. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake! To a silent stone, arise! See, some people prefer to use stone to make their idols, and they carve them up. How good is that for you? Can a stone save you? No. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath in it at all. And he who is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So Habakkuk, God's word through Habakkuk says, idolatry is ridiculous. Instead, you need to be worshiping he who is from the very beginning, the creator of heaven and earth, the God of the Israeli people. Have a great Lord's Day worshiping Jesus, the King of Kings.